This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. From Maine, writer Ariel Saber will join us by telephone. She's written the award-winning book, Measured Words, Computation and Writing in Renaissance Italy. Ariel, welcome.
Thank you so much, Grace.
Your book has received 3 major awards, and it's still going strong. So at least tell us what it's about.
Well, thank you. It's always a surprise as an academic when you win awards. You never think that more than 5 people will read your work, so it's a great honor and pleasure to have received them. The book is really, in just a few words, it's a look at how mathematical writing and thinking and literary writing and thinking can intersect, and why in the Renaissance it was such a great time for that conversation.
You have featured 4 principal characters from that period. First of all, will you tell us what span of years we're talking about?
Right. So I'm looking at the mid-1400s to the very early years of the 1600s, basically around the time of the birth of the printing press in Europe and the beginnings of calculus. And it's also a time in which Italy is really the center of mathematical study for many different reasons. So it's a really good time to be seeing how, through the printing press, language is being and writing is being rethought and reconfigured, and the mathematical world is doing the same.
I felt as if I had entered another world when I entered this book, that all the lights in the world went on. I never realized that letters were being created, that were being refigured. I felt that the A was always an A and had just come down from heaven to visit us, right? And I am so interested in the formulation of these characters. Is one of your purposes to say that language is like mathematics?
I think that there are so many different connections in that way. And the particular authors that I look at all sort of look at something to do with language or writing. And by writing, I also mean the physical act of writing, calligraphic, typographic, and also the inscriptions on stone lapidaries that we see all over Europe, actually coming from more ancient times. And so the intersection between what the mathematicians were doing in their measurements and what the people who were writing were doing are very strong in this period. And the first author, Leon Battista Alberti, wrote a cryptography, which is considered the first text of modern cryptography. He wrote this in 1466. It was not meant to travel. It was meant just for the papal court and for a secretary he knew very well who was having to code and decode documents. And he really, in that short work, looks at how letters can be, how you can break them down into frequencies and in a given language, and how you can manipulate almost combinatorically, mathematically, letters to create stronger or less strong codes. And so he's considered the grandfather of modern cryptography.
First of all, tell us what cryptography is.
Yes. So it's the creation and interpretation of codes, of breaking codes. And so what he does is he finds a way to encode messages that's called the polyalphabetic cipher, where he's using multiple alphabets in letters in different orders, not the usual order, and he is asking the coder to change what they call the key, that is the thing that would unlock a code, many times throughout a message. And this is an incredibly complex idea, a simple idea, but it creates an incredibly complex, hard-to-break code.
Tell me.
And in fact, yeah.
Tell me this. Would this be the beginning of computers?
In some ways, parts of this would lend themselves to that future form of computation, because when we're looking at the what I call the atoms or elements of language, which are letters, and of course with computing, you've got zeros and ones, you're manipulating a set, a small group of these elements and trying to figure out ways to have them create messages or deconstruct messages. And so in some ways, I would say yes. And of course, the kinds of coding devices and machines we have in the modern world are very linked to computers and computation.
I needed your illustrations to help me, and I saw his wheels. The wheels that turned in different ways and matched up different letters. And this is a book for the general public. I must say, they should not be afraid if they see some Roman numerals, but because I feel that it is basic to everything that's happening today, and no one is informed about the early practices. So we have Bardi, who was a person with computation, and name some of the other featured principles.
So there's three others. I'll just say their names. Luca Pacioli, who comes chronologically right after Alberti, and then Niccolò Tartaglia, and then the last one is Giambattista della Porta. And they're interesting also because even though they're spread across this 150 years, they all sort of have connections to each other in different ways, which I talk about in the introduction. And two of them are of very high class and high education and write primarily in Latin, and two of them are less so and write primarily in Italian, in the vernacular. And there are real debates going on at this time about which is better to do. Who is your audience? Who do you want to read your work and understand it and benefit from it? So the other thing that's neat about all four of these authors and this time is that mathematics was still primarily written in words.
Amazing. I can't even get my mind around that. Mathematics.
I know. So
was
numbers we had. We had Arabic numbers by this time in Europe. So they'd moved on from the Roman numerals in mathematical context. And yet all the conventions, the plus signs, the minus signs, the things we know and love now, didn't come until the end of the 1500s when they start to solidify and become what everyone is using in the mathematical world. So it took a very long time for that to stabilize, and so people wrote out in words formulae and proofs.
Really?
So equations.
Mm-hmm. Ariel Saber, are there many of you out there? I mean, this is really...
It's a funny... Thank you for asking that. It's a funny question. To be a literary scholar who loves math is probably not that common. Most people, I think, divide themselves into one or the other, though, of course, there are wonderful people we could point to who have mastered both, and I certainly wouldn't consider myself mastering mathematics in any sense.
But have a background. You must have a background in math.
I did some, for sure. I did a lot of logic in college. I was a philosophy major, and I've just always been fascinated about how mathematics actually can be considered a language. People throw that out a lot, saying math is a language, but they never explain how and why.
Exactly.
And the question I've asked many students who are math majors that I work with, they find me here at Bowdoin, is how is math, or even is mathematics, something that can be equivalent to narrative?
Oh.
Or is it poetry?
Ariel, I am so happy I found you, and I have found a new field for the rest of my life. And I want everyone to know who you are. Ariel is a professor of Romance Languages and Literature at Bowdoin College in Maine, with her PhD in Italian literature. And she's published on medieval and early modern Italian literature, mathematics, print history, and advice manuals, whatever they are, experimental electronic music, and science fiction. And I just have to say that she's won Yale's Field Prize for her best work of poetry, literature, and religion at Yale. She has won a prize for teaching at Bowdoin. And now, Measured Words, Computation and Writing in Renaissance Italy, has won the MLA Scaglioni's Prize, the Newbery Libraries Award, and the Bridge Award for the American Initiative for Italian Culture, related here to the Italian Embassy and the Embassy in Rome. And it will be translated into Italian, which seems so right, doesn't it, Ariel?
I'm very honored. Yes, thank you.
Now, we have Alberti Pacioli And now Della Porta, what did he do?
So Della Porta is sort of the wild card in this text. He was a physician and a playwright and is considered a magus, a magician, but not a a real one, or one that you would, you know, a sort of Harry Potter one, someone who could actually do magic. But for him, magic meant early chemistry, kinds of alchemy, and early forms of science, looking at nature and seeing how to do things with it.
Are you the only one who's an expert on him?
Nope. There are definitely a handful of people who work on him. He's actually also famous for criminal physiognomy. He studied people who were hanging in the gallows in Naples in the 1500s.
Wow.
And looked at their body type, their faces, their hands, to try to see if there was something in people's bodies that indicated their criminal tendencies. So he was sort of interested in everything. Mm-hmm. Extremely learned, and he wrote a book called On Natural Magic in English, and he wrote two versions, but one version that he wrote had 20 different topics, 20 books in it, and it became a huge, huge hit all over Europe. So he is a polymath, but also trafficking in some odd things, for sure. And at the end of his life, he decided to write a book on curves, literally different kinds of curves and how to construct them. And what I love about the book is that it's very curious. It's not using any new mathematics. He makes complicated things look easy and easy things look spectacularly hard. And then he tries to square the circle and believes that he has done so.
Oh, Arielle Saber is with us. And she has written this astonishing book, Measured Words, Computation and Writing in Renaissance Italy. I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're at the Library of Congress. Our fourth person is Tartaglia, and he wrote the solution to a cubic equation. What is a cubic equation?
So many of us learn in high school, or maybe even middle school, the quadratic equation. And this is the next level up. It's an algebraic equation for us now, though it can be actually solved geometrically. But basically, it's how we can be given an equation with some missing elements to it and figure it out through a particular method. And what's interesting for me is not just that he was the person or one of the people around the same time to come up with a surefire way to solve cubic equations, but that he hid, or maybe not hid, this is a debate, he put the solution, and it's a three-part solution, in a poem. And in a poem that's in terza rima, in tercets, which is, of course, Dante's metric and verse form, and he puts it in terza rima, and it's a interesting document because he wrote it, he says, to help with his memory of the process for the solution, but he also gave it to somebody who was very famous at the time, a mathematician named Girolamo Cardano, who wanted the equation to publish in a book he was publishing. And Tartaglia resisted because he knew if he gave him the solution, Cardano would publish it before him.
Yes.
So he puts it in a poem to make it harder.
But you mean other people could read the poem.
Exactly.
And if they understood the terza rima, they could understand the formula, though.
Exactly.
So how was it hidden?
Actually, this particular poem and this exchange between Tartaglia and Cardano in the mid-1500s sets off what is considered one of the first intellectual property cases. Because in the end, Cardano does figure it out with a little more help from Tartaglia. He promises things to Tartaglia that he actually isn't able to fulfill. He does credit Tartaglia in his book, but still publishes it before Tartaglia. And this, of course, infuriates Tartaglia because this was his ace in the pocket for job applications, for progress in his own career. So it's an interesting, interesting phenomenon. And the chapter that I look at is really going into not a ton about the mathematics itself, but more about why did he put it in a poem.
Yes. It is fascinating. And these four characters are, you say, just four among many. You've just chosen some. But these men who are interdisciplinary were artists, architects, mathematicians, musicians. It is astounding to us to realize the field they covered. And you early on must have been triggered by something very special to make you go into this field. When did you first begin, as an Italian scholar, when did you first realize that there were mysteries that only you could find?
Well, or only I was interested in
that. Yeah, but why? Why? Why were you interested in it?
I wrote my PhD dissertation on Giordano Bruno, who was a philosopher burned at the stake in 1600 in Rome for thinking and saying things such as the universe is infinite, which is a hard thing for us to view as heretical now, but was back then. And he said many other things, too, that were quite disturbing. But he was a fascinating, prolific, powerful writer who went to courts all over Europe. And my dissertation and first book was looking at how, when he was writing his philosophy and his poetry, he wrote poetry too, when he was writing, how it was that you could see, you could almost see underneath his rhetoric, underneath his choice of structuring his sentences and ideas, a kind of geometry. And I started to look at what I call the geometry of language, circumlocution, hyperbole, ellipses, all of these tropes that we use in literary contexts and even speaking and giving orations have a spatial basis to them and have shape. And so in looking at Bruno, I organized the chapters by, I think it was lines, angles, curves, and the point. And so in each case, I looked at one of his texts and sort of showed how he was aware of this spatiality to his language, used it to further emphasize some of the philosophical points he was making, which were often about the shape of the universe and the nature of the universe.
Ariel, I mean, your curiosity is beyond. So you actually established the idea that geometry was beneath the written word?
I think it is, whether we're aware of it or not. We write linearly on a page from left to right in English, other ways in other languages. And when we're speaking, of course, we're not seeing anything visually. But conceptually, language is built on space and spatial representation.
I love this. So, I love, you're talking my talk now.
I'm so glad.
I love it. And we have now this author, Ariel Saber, this book, Measured Words, Computation and Writing in Renaissance Italy, this book, which is actually being appreciated for its originality and innovative information. Would you just read us a paragraph from your book?
I thought I would read maybe the first page of the introduction. And so it starts with a quote from William James, which is that the union of the mathematician with the poet, ellipses, this is surely the ideal. Okay, so starting with the first sentence. There were computers in Renaissance Italy, excellent and varied computers. They were the people who calculated quantities, formulated algorithms, proposed new mathematical objects and equations, tested proofs. These matematici, aritmetici, computisti, contisti, geometri, misuratori, and pesatori worked in tandem with writers, some of them also exceptional computers, who took calculated risks, formulated rules for good lettering, calligraphic, epigraphic, and typographic, and textual style, proposed new ways of thinking about alphabets and language, tested their mathematical ideas in words. In this period of Italy's history, both computation and writing were in a dynamic process of identity conjuring. Like others among Italy's increasing number of upwardly mobile citizens, Renaissance computer writers were not only calculating and measuring their words, they were actively seeking to demonstrate their value to society and to showcase their contributions to the larger search for knowledge. As Neil Rhodes, Jonathan Salde, and the contributors to their 2000 edited volume, The Renaissance Computer, Knowledge, Technology, and the First Age of Print, As they have shown, the 15th and 16th centuries experienced an information explosion much like the end of the 20th and beginning of the 21st centuries. Then, as today, writers and computers were faced with radically new, powerful ways to produce knowledge, circulate it, and understand it. Some might say that information theory and the digital humanities began hundreds of years ago.
That is the voice of Ariel Saber with her new book, Measured Words, and it is truly going to another planet for me. The printing press was available and must have been of some assistance to them, Ariel, is that true?
Yes. This is one of the starting points for my thinking. So the Giordano Bruno topic and the geometry of language led me to ask what else was going on in this period of 15th and 16th century Italy to have the Renaissance, we hear that quote, Renaissance man. What is that? How do you do that? How do you speak and work so interdisciplinarily as they did? And what does that mean to us today?
Yes.
And so from Bruno, I jumped into these other authors. And of course, there were many others I could have chosen, Leonardo da Vinci, Galileo, many, many other people who were competent in all the liberal arts and very, very more than competent. So one of the things about the printing press that's so fascinating, actually Alberti, who is my first chapter, the one on cryptography, he gets his idea for creating his polyalphabetic cipher from understanding how the printing press works. The second chapter on Luca Pacioli, who I study at the end of one of his texts, he has an alphabet in which he outlines and discusses how to construct the ideal shape and proportions of Roman capital letters, whether you're engraving them on stone or writing them or painting them. And he has an entire book called On Divine Proportion. And by divine, he means many different things, not just the golden mean. He means divinity in other Renaissance Christian ways of thinking of divinity. But the alphabet is fascinating because he includes this in a mathematical study of great, complex ratios. And so suddenly the letter, again, this atom and this element of language, of writing, becomes something that is mathematized. And what I love to point out to people when I talk about this chapter is that the letters that he produces, the proportions he produces, become the basis for our font, Times New Roman, that we use today.
Yes, that fascinated me because your illustrations help so very much. When I see that A and the curves and the squares that actually help to create it, as I say, the walls come down. The walls come down. To get back to these four principles that are in this book, how do they subsist? Who supported them? Was there an academy that, I mean, how do they keep a roof over their heads? They were individual scholars, independent scholars. Tell me about their daily lives.
Their daily lives. That's one of the things that was a real joy for me in writing this book, too, is that I asked that same question. How were they the right person at the right time to be able to do what they did? And so I did get to look into their biographies, and they all have such different ones. The first one and the last one, Alberti and Della Porta, came from more well-to-do families. So that was great for them. Alberti's is a little complicated because he was born illegitimate into the Alberti family. And then because he was brilliant, he was able to work his way up into positions. They're called secretaries, the people who were really the right-hand people, men, to powerful other men, popes or dukes or princes. So he earned his keep that way, but he wrote an incredible amount of literature and philosophy, and also was an architect and an artist himself. So he had many ways of earning money after he was not exactly rejected from the Alberti family, but not funded the way Della Porta was. So that's how they managed to be able to do what they did. And the two middle authors, Pacioli and Tartaglia, they were teachers. They were teachers. They were full-time teachers and worked very, very hard at it and had to have patrons to help them get their books written and published, just as we do today.
Yes.
We need grants and fellowships and patrons.
Yes.
And they were people, these two, Pacioli and Tartaglia, who were definitely more concerned with writing in the vernacular so more people could have access to their ideas.
That's brilliant. That is so interesting. This book has changed me considerably. And I would like to know, as we round out our conversation, what's next for Arielle Saber?
Well, let's see. I have some ideas that I'd like to pursue regarding this concept of humanism, inhumanism, posthumanism, transhumanism that we are looking at in the contemporary world now. What's next for human evolution? What's next with all of the technology that we live with and that keeps changing and changing us? And so once again, going back to the Renaissance and looking at what they thought of was the nature of the human and what we are and what we should be. Maybe we're not always what we should be.
Where are you going to start this research?
Well, I taught a course. I was invited to be the Speroni Chair of Medieval and Renaissance Literature at UCLA this past quarter, and I taught a graduate course on this topic, and so it's starting to reveal itself to me now. I have that project, and I have a project I want to work on eventually on Dante and the concept of symmetry, mathematical symmetry. So that's a very specific Dante Divine Comedy project. And then I have to finish an anthology I started a few years ago on Italian science fiction, translating about 25 short stories into English. And that will, when that's done, if it comes out, will be the first anthology of Italian science fiction in English. So that,
Arielle, I just have to say that I have just met someone I will never forget. I'm going to watch you in your meteoric rise. I'm going to follow your stardust, and we're going to be sitting and waiting for your next book. So we have been hearing the voice of Arielle Saber, and this is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. The series is produced by Forest Woods Media Production, post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making this program possible. Funding is provided by the Witter Binner Foundation for Poetry, the Reva and David Logan Foundation, with additional support from the Sinipid Fund and Catherine Wood Enterprises. Our engineer is Mike Turpin. I'm Grace Cavalieri.